So Will, you are a hero to many of the people here, thanks to the book you co-authored called The Outsiders, and we will for sure talk about that in a few moments. But we would like to get to know Will the person first. So why don't we start, why don't you tell us, where do you come from? Tell us a little bit about your childhood and perhaps some of the formative experiences that led to you becoming an investor.
Great. So Rob, it's just great to be here. It's been 6 years since I was last here. And it's remarkable to see the growth in the audience here and the energy level. And so anyway, it's great to be here.
Thank you.
So I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I grew up there. I went to school there through college. And I basically spent most of my working life there. So fairly parochial in that sense. I'm the oldest of two brothers in a family of four. Grew up, as I say, in the Boston area. And my wife, who I met in college, also is from the Boston area. And we have two children. My son, Nick, who is our youngest, he's 26. He is an investor on the investing path in the allocator area, is what he's interested in. And then my daughter, Charlotte, our oldest, is 29. And she is doing a master's program in social work at Columbia University and living in New York City. So I come from that area. Someone asked me yesterday why I don't have a Boston accent. And I think that's because my dad is from a family that's been in Boston for a while. But my mom is from New York, and I think their accents sort of canceled each other out. So I ended up with something in the middle. And let's see. So.
How did you get into investing? What was the kind of initial trigger?
My career arc would be a bit unusual by contemporary standards in that I started after college. I got hired by a company that was owned by a high school friend of mine, a publishing business, and he offered me a job before my senior year started. So before I had even begun thinking about what I might do professionally. And this was the 1980s when the whole world of recruiting was very different than it is now. You did not need to get your career internship as a freshman in order to be headed down an investment path. So I worked for this business, which was a publishing business, for 4 years right out of college. And I had, by virtue of that connection with my friend and that family, I was given sort of undue responsibility very early on. So I had an excellent experience working there. But I knew from very early on that that was not what I wanted to do. And I had had this experience where in the first summer after college, I had gone to Maine on vacation. And I had brought books for that vacation, and it had been a rainy, foggy weekend, which can happen in Maine, even in the summer. And so I had blown through my book list. And I looked around the house I was staying in, and I pulled down a book called The Money Masters by John Train. I don't know how many people here have read that book, but that is an excellent investing book. It's 1980 was when it was published, but it's still highly relevant. I read that book, the first chapter of which is on Buffett, very early in Buffett's career. And I immediately knew that's what I wanted to do. Light bulb moment went off for me. So the balance of the time I was working in the operating company, I was reading voraciously and doing what little investing I could afford to do. I sent away for all of the Berkshire letters, which you used to have to do by mail. You'd send out a note and it would come back, these thick, thick packets of material. And anyway, so I went to business school, the Stanford Business School after that, and was fortunate enough to have a professor there named Jack McDonald, who is sort of a legendary professor. He was sort of a, this would be, I went to business school in the very early 90s, and he was a pocket of fundamental investing in a world of efficient markets theory. And he taught two classes in his spring class. If you got a good grade in the fall class, this was in the second year, then you were invited to the spring seminar, in which the format was you just showed up at the class and a different amazing investor would come and talk to you for 2 hours. No prep. It was a perfect class for the spring of your second year at business school. And I just had a wonderful time in that class, and I was exposed in that class to a variety of investors. Buffett came every single year but my year because he was running Solomon Brothers. He'd been called into Solomon Brothers, so I missed Buffett. But I got to meet an investor named Tim Bliss, who works with an investment firm called the Investment Group of Santa Barbara, and had a chance to do some work with him, and was influenced early on by some of those ideas. Anyway, so I worked with T. Rowe Price in the summer between years in business school. That was a fantastic experience. They used to hire one student every summer, and then they would give them an industry and all of the resources of the firm, and then basically leave them alone, at the end of which you'd have to come back and give a report on them. And I was given the temporary help industry, which had never been covered there before. So that was a wonderful experience. So I knew I wanted to be an investor. I'd had this experience with Tim Bliss in my second year, and I was evaluating my options, including going back to T. Rowe and some other investing opportunities, and a private investor in the Boston area.
T. Rowe is still happy to take you after the report.
We'll see. Yeah, they seem to be. They seem to be, actually. So, yes, they must not have been paying attention or something. But I was connected with an individual investor in the Boston area who approached me about going to work for him and a friend of his to invest personal capital in a very unstructured format, where I was paid $60,000 in income, but was given a carried interest in their capital. And so they hired me, and I went to work in a closet in their office in the Back Bay of Boston. And over the next 4 years, we made 8 investments, all of them in private companies. 3 of them we still own, right? So basically almost 30 years later. So I had an early exposure to long-term holds. And then from there, I ended up starting the private equity firm that I've been involved with, was involved with for a long time.
Housatonic Partners?
Housatonic Partners. And I've been investing on my own in a family office called the Cromwell Harbor Partnership for about the last dozen years. So,
what a journey. And you also have some interesting board memberships, which you've also joined.
Yes, I have 2 public company. I mean, I'm involved with lots of private company boards as an investor in private companies over a long period of time. I have 2 public companies that I'm involved with in board capacities. One is a company called CNX Resources, which is an energy company. A natural gas business now. It's morphed into that, where I've been on the board for about 10 years. But weirdly, I've been the board chair for 9 of those years. And that's been an extremely fun project, working with the CEO there, a guy named Nick DeIulius, in implementing some of the philosophy and ideas that were covered in detail in the book. We can talk more about that. And then I'm also involved with a company called Perimeter Solutions, which is a leading manufacturer of or producer and manufacturer of wildfire retardant for suppressing wildfires, actively, unfortunately, in use in Southern California right now. And I'm involved in that on that board with Nick Howley, who's the CEO of TransDigm, and we are the co-chairman of that board, which has been great, you know, great fun, very. You know, very interesting in both cases. So those have been great learning experiences.
Yeah, and I also listened to a great podcast series you did a couple of years ago with the TransDigm CEO, TransDigm being one of the great companies out there. How did that relationship come about?
Yeah, so I've known Nick for a long time now. Nick Howley, yeah. Who's the CEO, longtime CEO of TransDigm. He's now the chairman of TransDigm and then co-chairman at Perimeter Solutions. And TransDigm just has this, I don't know, how many people here are familiar with TransDigm? Okay, so I don't need to repeat it. So TransDigm is sort of unique on multiple dimensions. It's a terrific business. Their game selection was excellent, so an excellent industry. But within that, they've designed a formula for optimizing per share equity value that's sort of extraordinary. And if you just look at the math of that, it's basically about a 30-year record since Nick was involved. Roughly half the time, it was owned by 3 different private equity firms. And the second half of the time, it's been a public company. And the compound returns over, again, I think it's 31 or 32 years or 36%, something, you know, extraordinary. Incredible. Like that. But if you look at the 2 halves, the private equity period and the public equity period, the returns are the same for both. Which is just that's a very unusual pattern. And they continue. So that's been an extraordinary company. And So we did a podcast in pretty great detail, more detail, I think, than most people were interested in. But that's been, we have one other that is coming out soon that's similarly detailed, but we're very slow as a result. It takes us a while.
Right, I can't wait for that. So let's get to the book. We've got a mixed crowd here. I would guess probably about 90% have read the book cover to cover five times at least, if not more, but probably 10% who haven't got a clue what we're talking about. So for their benefit, why don't you just in a few words just describe what the book The Outsiders is?
The book is it's a study of eight high-performing CEOs. High-performing meaning they had exceptionally high returns, stock market returns, all the companies were publicly traded, they sort of needed to be, over their tenures. And their tenures needed to be long enough to, you know, sort of roughly 15 to 20 years on average so that we could see the data across two full business cycles. And there were two tests. They had to have returns that were better than Jack Welch's returns when he was the CEO at GE. Jack Welch's reputation has been significantly and justifiably tarnished in the last 12 years. But when I was working on the book, he still had sort of a, you know, a status as sort of a...
It's almost like a byword for the great CEO was Jack Welch.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be a Jack Welch.
Formerly known as Jack Welch, yeah. But his returns were excellent. He had basically a 20% return for 20 years with, you know, off in GE. So you had to at least meet that absolute threshold, and then you needed to have meaningfully better returns than the peer group over your tenure. And I think that second test is actually maybe the more relevant test. It's sort of this idea of duplicate bridge, right? So you needed to, basically the idea is that over long periods of time in an industry, everybody has dealt basically the same hand. And so if one company meaningfully outperforms the peer group, that's worthy of study. And so all eight of these CEOs fit that pattern. And then go ahead.
Yeah, and then the book is called The Outsiders. So why was it called that? And what were the common characteristics of these eight CEOs?
So the personal characteristics, basically what's interesting is people would generally associate CEOs with being charismatic, strategic, visionary types. And those are actually not the adjectives you would use to describe this group of eight. Instead, you would use words like pragmatic, flexible, cool, rational, humble, data-oriented.
Contrarian.
This is a very different set of personal characteristics than you might think. All of them were first-time CEOs. So that might be the most surprising finding in the whole book. It does not get as much attention. But eight for eight, all eight of them were first-time CEOs.
And describe their track record.
Yeah, the track record's extraordinary. I mean, the range, the tenures varied, but they were on average about 20 years, so very long records. And the returns tended to congregate around 20% over 20 years. Right, so pretty extraordinary in public market settings. There were some exceptions to that. John Malone, in particular, had a meaningfully higher longer-term return profile, partly because he was in a rapidly growing industry, the cable television industry, in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. And so, they were multiples better than the peer group and, you know, many multiples better than the market in all cases. And then there was some very specific, their sort of approach to how they ran their companies was very different from the peer group, but very similar to each other, very similar across the group. And so some of the specific examples of that are that they did not typically pay dividends. They viewed dividends as being tax inefficient because they're taxed twice, as came up yesterday. They tended to very selectively repurchase their shares, and when they did do that, they tended to do it quite aggressively. They were sporadic users of M&A as a value creation device, and they had an excellent record in M&A, a very high batting average, so to speak, you know, which is generally very much not the case for corporate America. And they tended to run extremely decentralized organizations, right? So I think one of the themes that's lost a little bit in the book is, I think it's a book about resource allocation, And there's sort of a framework for that that relates to capital allocation. That's part of it. But if you looked at how they actually ran the firms themselves, they tended to have this bias for decentralization. And that means very few people at corporate, and the autonomy and prestige in the organizations pushed down into the local business units. To an extreme degree, I'd say in half of the eight, they would be almost crazily decentralized. Yeah, certainly relative to the peers. Yeah.
Do you think, I think the biggest takeaway for many people about the book was the role and the importance of capital allocation. Do you think that gets too much attention, or?
I think it gets the most attention for sure. It's very important. And it's interesting, I mean, having had this experience with these two public companies, I've had a firsthand look at how that works in public company context. Most of my investing has been in private companies over the course of my career. But I do think the other sort of areas of resource allocation are talent and human resource, this, you know, around that decentralization theme. And then the allocation of the CEO's own time turns out to be very important and not really focused on. But this group had a real bias for, there were things they just did not do. They typically spent almost no time on investor relations. Little to no time on investor relations. They tended to spend a lot of time, scheduled time, on their own calendars by themselves, that have actually slots of time. Buffett, of course, is famous for this, but where they were just reading or thinking or writing off, often removed from the office. And you said different things that they did in terms of how they tended to have very strong COO type number twos, who typically had oversight for the operations, these decentralized operations.
And what has been the impact of the book for you personally, but also in the world, wider corporate world?
And so for me personally, it's dramatically, wildly exceeded very low expectations. So it's led to all sorts of very fun, interesting interactions with both CEOs and investors. And that continues actually sort of to a remarkable degree. And that's sort of in North America, but also more broadly. I mean, witness, you know, this group here today. So that's been super fun and lively and interesting and surprising for me. And then I think it has had some impact on thinking amongst CEOs and in corporations, but actually I think maybe less so than you might think. You know, I think the core of some of these ideas, we were talking about this in a group yesterday, but I think it's a little bit like Buffett talks about value investing, where he sort of says, people either get it in the first 15 minutes or they never get it. Yeah. You can spend days with them and they won't get it. It either resonates early on or it doesn't. I think that's very much the same with some of these ideas, particularly the ideas around capital allocation. In public companies, even if the CEO buys in, there's the hurdle of the board. You need to have the board also buy in, and that can be increasingly challenging as board sizes have generally grown in public companies. Not a good trend, in my opinion. I would say the two companies that I'm involved with, we've worked hard to keep our boards, by public company standards, quite small, sort of 7 or 8 people, which I think really helps productivity. Yeah.
Yeah, sadly, that's been my experience as well. My impression is if someone doesn't, you know, oftentimes you have a company with great business, makes lots of money, pays everything out as a dividend, and you're like, well, why not do a share buyback? It's much more mathematically, it's factually more efficient, but you very rarely change people's mind on that.
It's true, and you know, this returning capital to shareholders idea gets talked about widely, but people don't really think about the mechanics of that. Yeah. They just want to check the box and be able to talk about it on interviews and in the media. But there's, and even when they do make a decision to repurchase shares, the typical way they do that is they announce an authorization, usually with great fanfare, and they then execute it in the form of quarterly incremental repurchases, equal quarterly, which is not at all, if you looked at the 8 CEOs in the book, only 7 of them repurchased shares. Buffett was not a repurchaser at that time, the other 7. But their pattern was entirely different. They would wait long periods of time and do nothing. And then every now and then, when the stock got really cheap, they would buy large chunks of it. You know, Malone, there's a story of Malone during the GFC. showing up at one of the Liberty, within one of his Liberty entities, and having repurchased 11% of shares in the last month. That's a much more typical pattern for this group.
Yeah. So part of the rationale for this weekend is to help emerging managers. And as I was listening to you speak, you know, you described all the incredible connections and things that happened when you published this wonderful book. And speaking to my friend Ted here, who has a blog, and he was telling me, brought him into connections with some interesting people. And for me personally, I think my letters were the reason that people got to know me, and why probably everyone is sitting here today. So I think putting something intelligent out there and taking the time to write it is one of life's great hacks to get connected, right?
Yeah, I wish I'd discovered it earlier.
Yeah, so what happens to when people understand how I like to invest, what kind of companies I look for, people tend to reach out to me and say, hey, you should take a look at company XYZ, you're gonna love it. In fact, International Petroleum, I know several people in the room here, drew my attention to it before I invested in it, so thank you for that. But I can imagine something similar happens to you, so maybe you could share some of the companies which you've sort of discovered subsequent to writing the book, and which you might perhaps include in the second edition.
Yeah. So that's been one of the byproducts of those interactions, which has been very fun. So I think one of the interesting things I've discovered, or one of the learnings along the way, is sort of the power of these ideas in commodity businesses. And I think, you know, Will yesterday, you know, sort of was an exemplar of that, where in a pure commodity business like energy, and again, the company I'm involved with, CNX, is also, you know, commodity energy business. I think having a sort of capital allocating philosophy of sort of long-term equity value per share optimizing philosophy is in itself a bit of a competitive advantage. And you can sort of see it in what I would call cyclical compounders. And I would put credit acceptance in that category, you know, where they're on their own cycle in the industry. They get traded often with their peers, even though they've evolved an entirely different and much better model. But that provides them with the opportunities to massively repurchase shares during these recurring downturns. And there's another company in the US called NVR, which is a home building business, which is typically a terrible business, or not terrible, but a very difficult, capital intensive, cyclical business. But NVR has a similar philosophy, where they've evolved a capital efficient model to that, so a differentiated model. But they tend to trade with the peer group anyway. And when there are downturns, they aggressively repurchase shares. And like credit acceptance, they have an amazing 30-year record. So those would be two examples. In the sort of serial acquisition world, you know, the record that Nick has at TransDigm speaks for itself, but there are other analogs for that. Probably the best example and best known one, or a really interesting one, is Mark Leonard at Constellation Software. I'm sure many of you are familiar with him. Those who aren't, I would strongly encourage you to read his letters back to front, earliest days, to, you know, what, see the evolution in the thinking there. They're excellent letters, and they lay out a philosophy you know, that's created sort of extraordinary value, continues to, like TransDigm's. So those would be a couple.
Yeah. Do you think letters are a powerful signal for a thoughtful outsider CEO?
It's a great question. I think they're the most powerful signal, honestly. I think that in the early days, when a new CEO takes over, like eventually you can evaluate the record, right? Ultimately, you know, it's specific and quantitative, and you can evaluate the record. But in the early years, before there is a record, the question is, what are the markers? What are the signals? And I think far and away, the most predictive one is vocabulary. It's the way the CEO writes and talks about their business. They get extra credit if they've evolved differentiated metrics, different ways of thinking about the business that they're in. At the energy company I'm in, as an example, and I'm not sure this is a perfect example, and we're early days still, we'll see how, but we're optimizing that business for free cash flow per share, period. And we're very clear about that. And it may be the only energy company in the country that's like, well, free cash flow per share. I think that Will and the Lundins are on that program, but it's a large industry and there are very few players who are. So I think, you know, metrics and vocabulary can be very predictive. Of course, you then need to see that the team is executing and following up on those on that vocabulary. But I think that's something to look for. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, extremely decentralized organizations would be another thing. Yeah. If you see that, that's an interesting signal. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when we spoke a few weeks ago, you said you were toying with the idea to a follow-up to the book. Is it too early to talk about it, or is there any? Can you give us a little sneak preview of what it might be about?
Yeah. So it's a bit too early, but what it's not going to be is just a series of other CEO profiles. I sort of feel like those ideas are in the original book. There are a couple of detailed chapters that I'd like to do, one on a nonprofit CEO, actually in the allocator space that I've done some work on. So I think there'll be a little bit of that. And then I think there's some related topics that I personally find very interesting. And so I'm doing some writing and thinking about that. Whether the audiences will, I don't know, we'll find out. But a lot of that around the idea of, you know, I sort of described earlier my earliest investing, you know, at Housatonic when I was in the closet, so to speak, and the fact that we still own through. I think really looking in detail at longer term holds and some of the ramifications and topics around that, there's some interesting.
Yeah.
So I'm going to spend some time on that, I think, and we'll see where it is. I'm a very slow writer, so it'll take some time.
That's wonderful. So I think we've got about 10 minutes left, so I'd love to give the audience also the opportunity to ask some questions. So there's Claudine there. The microphone is on its way, just about the fifth row back.
Hi, thanks. You've partially answered it with the idea of how you identify when there isn't a track record. How do you know this CEO is going to be good and create that kind of value when you don't have a track record? So you've said that the thoughts that come through letters might help. But I'd be interested in, have you looked at any of the investors that managed to do that work and identify it and have ridden those stocks rather than, you know, seeing at the end, you know, how many people made that money other than the CEOs themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are, and there, you know, they would, I think, be sprinkled around the room. I think there are a small number, a couple of handful of investors who have been on this program, so to speak, this philosophy, have been onto this philosophy early on, and have identified some of these companies in their earliest stages, and then held them across time. You know, so there are examples of that. Let's see. So I think in Credit Acceptance, Tom Triforos would be an example of that.
Yeah.
What an investor! He works with this company, this small, nobody knows, you know, Prescott. They have a quietly unbelievable 45-year record, and there's a lot of those out there, by the way. Quietly unbelievable records. Interestingly, they often migrate towards managing a small amount of outside capital to managing almost entirely their own capital, those investors, over time. There's sort of a natural migration, I would say, often. But anyway, so there are a handful who have done that.
And what about sort of spotting the outsider CEO before there's a 10-year or 20-year track record? How do you do that?
Again, I think it's vocabulary. I think it's vocabulary. I think the serial acquisition area is a very interesting area for this. That is not, it's just now getting some, but there's sort of a pocket of companies in the Nordics that have been doing this for decades. Very similar philosophies, surprisingly so. There are parts of the playbook they don't implement. They don't tend to repurchase shares the same way. There's a difference. But in terms of their per share value creation over time, it's been extraordinary in very decentralized structures. Around serial acquisition, different approaches, and they come off of sort of a family tree, a coaching tree. This company, Bergman and Beving. I think there are some examples.
Perfect. Is it Carlo, I think.
Yeah. So I'm curious how decentralized cultures can be maintained through decades of extreme growth, perhaps outside of the serial acquire model where it makes a little bit more sense. But these companies tending to pay people much more than average, are they attracting people who are very into the kind of non-hierarchical culture? I'm curious how you see that evolve at these companies.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that's a very tricky thing, right? The transition from the founder who implemented the culture and inculcated the culture, and how do you retain the essence of it going forward? And I've seen that in situations where it has worked and where maybe it hasn't worked as well. In the situation where it's worked, they've in almost every case, it's been insiders, people who had been working closely with that predecessor, founding CEO, or part of the core team. I was talking with Daryl at Trupanion, and it sounds like he's got someone who fits that profile. Maybe not in the decentralized model, but more generally his approach. It's harder with outsiders. It's harder with people coming from outside those cultures. And even with insiders, so to speak, it's not a given. It's challenging. But they are very powerful cultures when they're fully implemented, and they tend to have exceptionally high talent retention. It's one of the characteristics that you sort of see across those groups.
Right at the back there.
Hi, Will. Just had a question. You've been involved in search funds for a long time. How do you go about hiring people who might show traits of these outside CEOs?
When you say hire, do you mean in some of the private investing that I'm doing?
Yes, but also just thinking about what sort of context or what sort of training that creates these type of traits.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, if you look at the backgrounds in the book, using that as an example, it's kind of interesting. I mean, there out of the eight CEOs, there are more engineers than MBAs. There are four engineers, only two MBAs. And I do think there's a quantitative crispness around a lot of the CEOs in the book who fit that profile. And I think that's true across the Nick Deulius, who I'm working with at CNX, is an engineer by training too. So I think there's some of that. In the private companies I'm involved with, it's a slightly different set of characteristics that I look for and we look for. But I would also say across all of those, a characteristic is crispness in communication, both written communication and verbal communication. So long-windedness, there are very few examples of long-windedness correlating with these attributes, is what I would say. So
much wisdom, amazing. Who's next? Matthias at the front.
There's
one
here.
One at the back, and then we'll take you next, Matthias.
Hi, thanks for sharing your wisdom with us. My question is about which part you find the most challenging in writing the book, which characteristic might be more challenging to explain to investors when reading your book?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yes, which part you find the more challenging, which lesson you take out from that?
What do you find difficult in writing a book, and which countries do you have the most problems explaining to people the ideas in the book?
So the writing of the book is part of it? It took me a very long time to do that, as I said, sort of a year per chapter, which arose from the way I did the research and the people I worked with in the research capacity, which we could spend some more time on. But it took me a long time. In terms of the ideas in the book, that's a good question. The book has been translated into 17 languages, I think. It's going into Farsi soon, I think, so, which I'm quite proud of. I guess the area that I haven't seen it, Japan would be an area where interestingly, there's been some interest, but again, relative to the size of that economy and stock market and really entrepreneurial culture, surprisingly less so than you might expect. The Nordics would punch above their weights. Yeah.
Matthias.
Hi, Will. I have a question with regards to your experience in private and public investing, which is quite unique. I think most of us are more on the public side, and I think we can learn a lot from the private side as well. So actually two questions. One question is, which game would you suggest, especially for young investors, to choose between private and public? And then the second question would be, what are the things we on the public side can learn from private investing?
Good question. On the game selection question, I think I would say public market investing, because it's not easy, but the ideas are broadly available, and it doesn't require deep networks of sourcing. It's just hard to get in the game of buying private companies. It takes a lot of time. There's an upfront cost to that in a way that there isn't in public markets. And in public markets, you can get crazy disjunctions in valuation that you just don't have in private companies. Owners of private businesses just generally are much more rational in how they think about valuing their businesses. So you rarely get in, you know, I've had a couple of conversations this weekend of, you know, businesses that are trading at, you know, 25% of the value that they would, you know, understandably achieve in a well-run private auction. And you just don't find those sorts of disjunctions. So I think that's an easier game in that sense. Not an easy game, but it's an easier game. And then I do think it's a little bit like that Buffett expression about his experience as a CEO at Berkshire made him a better investor and vice versa. For me personally, that's been true in my private investing and my public market investing. There are sort of learnings from both sides that I have been able to apply to the other in ways that have, I think, improved and altered, enhanced my approach over time. So I think that cross-fertilization can be very powerful. And again, it goes back to the investment group of Santa Barbara, which is this group with an amazing record out in Southern California. It started in the public markets and evolved into private investing, more on the venture capital side, but their learnings on both sides of that continue to inform the investing in the other, and have in each case produced interesting edges for them versus peers.
Okay, we have a couple more questions, Carlo.
How do you manage your agenda and your space of mind between your public, your private investments, your board seats? Like, tell us a little bit about how you manage your time and how you think.
Yeah, I'd say I'm doing it, I'd say not perfectly would be the answer. The problem is that I like all of those activities, and I'm continually trying to concentrate my portfolio of time allocation, and I'm doing a B-minus job at best in that. But again, I really like all, and there's a lot of the board seats consume a lot of time, but I really enjoy those. The two public company boards, and I'm involved with about 8 private company boards. But I also love continuing to look at new investments, and so it's a constant, and there's some nonprofit activities that I'm doing more of, and so it's a constant struggle to figure out the right allocation of time. But I'm over 60 now, remarkably, so I've really made an effort in the last sort of 18 to 24 months to concentrate that portfolio, and I'm hopeful 24 months from now, if we were sitting here, I'd be better than a B minus, but I'd say at the moment I'm a B minus, yeah.
Well, you're doing very well for a 60-year-old.
Thank you.
So who would like to ask the last question? Andrew?
Yeah, so I feel like in the fund management world, there are a lot of people that learn how to talk the talk of being the next Warren Buffett or Robin Hall. But in the corporate world, I'm sure you see the same thing. Are there ways that you've seen to spot maybe, like, for lack of a better word, a pretender or somebody who's just saying and pretending to do the right thing?
Do you mean amongst investors or CEOs?
Amongst CEOs, or whatever you have more experience with, either side.
Yeah, I have more experience with CEOs, I think. I mean, again, I think it comes back to, can they crisply communicate their edge in their industry? And do they think in terms of per share value creation? Like, literally, if they use those two words consecutively, they get extra credit. You know, really. And so it sounds flip, and it really is a simple filter that I think is very powerful. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I once or twice was asked in the past, like, if someone writes like a 20-page, very thoughtful letter, are they pretending to be a thoughtful CEO? I'm like, well, they probably are a thoughtful CEO. Will, this has been incredible. I've studied everything you've written and spoken so deeply, and yet I still learned so much today. I think the two really big ideas which I loved was resource allocation, not just capital allocation, and maybe the opportunity to apply these ideas more fruitfully to cyclicals as opposed to the wide moat companies that people typically go after. But this has been truly incredible. Just before I allow you to give Will a big round of applause, one final question. A number of people have asked me, they would love to get a signed copy of your book. I'm sure you don't have 200 hard copies in your suitcase. Would it be okay if they send you a return envelope?
Absolutely, and again, Rob, thanks. Great to see you and great to be here.
Perfect, thank you so much.